happened was, and now we're going to die out in the desert shooting at helicopters. Hello and welcome to episode 181 of Ribbon of Memes as we emerge from our post-apocalyptic bunker and survey the world around us. We are moving on from the end of the world, but continuing with our theme of films that were widely considered to be the worst film of all time. I am Nick, the hapless lounge singer of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger,
the other hapless lounge singer of this podcast.
We make a fine comedic duo as we head on the road to Ishtar. Widely considered at the time to be the worst film of all time.
Though, again, we'll come back to that.
Yes. Yeah. So this is it was directed, one of the very few films we've ever talked about, unfortunately talked about in a very negative sense in this term, to be directed by a woman. In this case, Elaine May, who was a very competent screenwriter. She had a background in improvisational comedy. And I mention these things because it'll come back to explain some of the issues with the film, possibly, or at least they were used as reasons why there were some issues with the film.
Yeah, looking at her CV, I mean, she's an uncredited writer on a bunch of things like Reds and Tootsie and Labyrinth. Mm.
Birdcage, I think she did. She's done quite a few. That was all after this. I suspect for Elaine, her film, her life has largely been delineated by before Ishtar and after Ishtar, unfortunately for her.
I don't see any director credits.
No, she's never directed another film since. She's done a lot of writing, I believe, since. But she knew Warren Beatty.
And Warren Beatty owed her favours.
Yes.
Because she had written Heaven Can Wait, which was a huge success. She had done uncredited rewrites for him on Reds, which was another huge success. And he had a lot of money. And so basically he said, right, I will back the film you want to make.
Yeah, do whatever you want, I'll be in it, I'll back it, and he was in it as well. So her idea was a take on the Road to .. movies, which were
very much before both of our times, and unlike many of these things, I'm not particularly a fan, mostly from lack of exposure.
Well, I've not seen it. Was they're Rat Pack films, aren't they?
So
it was
not so much. It's mostly been Crosby and Bob Hope.
That's what I meant. Yes, not Rat Pack. Dean Martin and the other guy did similar things, but yes, you're right.
And the general style was Crosby is the self-assured ladies' man, and Bob Hope is the bumbler who gets lucky anyway. And there's this whole comedy double act thing going on as they get into more and more trouble.
Yes, so that was the idea. Let's do a modern take on that. So we have these two not particularly bright, certainly not particularly skilled lounge singers, but in their mind they are rivals of Simon and Garfunkel. They are... they write terrible songs that, you know,
they borrow a certain amount of the visual style as well.
Yes, they do. Yeah, I wondered if they were supposed to be fictionalized. In a way they are, but they are not, because they're entirely delusional at their abilities. And this is Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman.
Now this is where the film's production troubles start, because Warren Beatty and Elaine May were both known as perfectionists. And so they were looking around for somebody to be the other half of the double act, and a lot of people were saying, no, this is going to be a trouble production because you guys are both perfectionists.
Yeah, to the point of, like, hundreds of takes for every single thing, take after take.
And but Hoffman expressed reservations but was persuaded to come on board, and Hoffman, of course, is also known as a perfectionist at this point.
Can't see any problems with this at all.
So, yeah... And as a result, there was a certain amount of reluctance on the part of basically everybody else.
Mm.
But, yeah, they are... It's all right, I get a slight feeling of the beginning of Some Like It Hot. You know, they are out of money. They are in variously bad places. We get this flashback sequence of how they got to where they are now.
Well, this is my issue. This is the first film's odd choice, really. So we see that they are... they've got an agent. He's basically offered them this gig out, from their point of view as Americans, out in the arse end of nowhere, which is a fictional country in the Middle East adjacent to, I think, Saudi Arabia? Oh, certainly close to Libya.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get this... I don't know, it felt to me like quite a long flashback of them meeting and them losing their respective wives and girlfriends, and becoming this duo, and a sort of mutual bromance develops between them. Now, it's an odd choice because we're barely into the film and then we get this quite detailed, quite long, I think it's like 10-minute sequence of backstory before we've barely had the story. So it's a funny kind of... I thought it was a funny choice.
Now, I have no knowledge of the production of this. The impression I got is that it might have been something wedged in editing, or in some sense after the general ordering of the film had been done, because it seems to me that it is doing one big load-bearing job, which is trying to get me to like these guys.
Yes, I agree.
As far as I am concerned, it fails. But that's not the universal attitude.
Well, it didn't fail for me. So this early part feels like a very, like a kind of the improvisational style. And this is where I think the improv comedy really feels like not so much Spinal Tap, but a bit Spinal Tap. But the other Christopher Guest kind of improv films like A Mighty Wind or Best in Show. I'm a big fan of those kind of... And what they do is basically they improvise and they're filmed doing it, and then they pick the best bits and put them into a film. And it really felt like... here, I'm sorry to tell Dustin and Warren, they have not got the comedy chops of the, you know, the players in Spinal Tap, for instance.
It's also no insult to say you guys are not Bob Hope and Bing Crosby at the height of their powers.
Yes, yeah, it's fair enough. But that was, you know, that was much more tightly scripted screwball stuff, whereas this feels a lot looser, kind of. I don't know, I just felt like they were so earnest about getting into their character. You can imagine them trying, and it felt to me like they didn't want to waste any of that work they put in getting into these characters, so they filmed it and just jammed it in. That said, this part of the film I enjoyed pretty much more than any other part of the film. And I would personally, I understand, Roger, this isn't for you. But I did find them quite... I particularly was impressed with Beatty, who is, you know, a very confident, extremely charming, probably to his detriment.
Apparently he's supposed to be the Bob Hope bumbler of this duo.
Yeah. Well, I thought that worked quite well, because he does come across... I mean, you get the measure of... They're both... I didn't hate them. You know, they're idiots and they're rubbish at what they're doing. But I didn't hate them. I was happy to spend time... Because I didn't feel like it came from a position of malice. Yes, there is an element of the thing that you really hate. There's an element of, look at these morons. What a pair of idiots. But I felt... There was an affection for the characters that worked less well than the other films I've mentioned.
I think it would have worked better for me if they'd given an impression of perhaps a bit more self-awareness. You know, we know we're playing bottom-line venues and not getting paid much, but my God, we love doing it because this is the thing we love. That, I think it's trying to do that, but I don't think it does it.
Well, I think the key... When you're making comedy characters like this, they have to not be self-aware. That's the whole point of it. But otherwise, and unfortunately, yeah, that's how you can laugh at them, because they just don't understand. And all these famous, you know, British Captain Mannering is not self-aware. Blackadder is self-aware. But, you know, Basil Fawlty's not particularly self-aware. David Brent in The Office. They're all... They've got these monstrous characteristics that they're entirely unaware that that's what they like. So it's very much in the classic vein of comedy characters to not be self-aware. I do get that that's not not for you. Anyway, so we have these, I think, well-crafted characters. And I would have watched a film with them just bumming about in New York, you know, inside Llewellyn Davis. That is basically that entire film, is a guy who is... quite good. I mean, it's a much better film, obviously, but it's a similar thing of him just jobbing around New York and them trying to do things. I would have watched that film and probably would have enjoyed it. I don't know if you would. But instead of that, what we get is this bizarre, to me, kind of action comedy superimposed on these morons.
Because basically the one place that will give them a paying gig is a hotel in Marrakesh. Where the last act quit because they felt they would get shot if they didn't.
Yeah, so, and we now, thanks to the detailed backstory, we know why they are going to do it.
Because they're desperate for money.
Yeah, and then they get there, and then it turns into this kind of, I don't know quite where it goes from here. It just seems like a funny... So, almost immediately, the Dustin Hoffman character... is approached by a spy for the resistance, a rebel for the resistance. So this Ishtar is ruled by dictator, and there is
a dictator who is on good terms with the CIA, we should say.
Yes, he's a CIA-backed dictator. I mean, don't know where they got that idea from, because, you know, it wouldn't happen in reality. But... He's sort of drawn into this den of intrigue because she takes his... He gives her his wallet and he gives her his passport and his wallet, I think.
On the basis that she can use the passport to get out of the country, he, as an American, can say, I lost my passport and just get a replacement because everybody expects stupid American to lose his passport.
That's the implication. Yeah, yeah. So he goes along with it. The actor instantly is Isabella Gianni.
Yeah, one of the I'm not sure where she is in terms of star power at this point. One of the most attractive female actors working at this date. I think it is fair to say that would be a fairly consensus viewpoint.
Yes.
not just old perverted Roger, and almost entirely hidden under a headscarf.
Yes, she's not.
Which is an odd thing to do.
She was Warren Beatty's girlfriend at the time. She's probably half his age at a rough guess looking at them, but that is not unusual for Hollywood stars. Whether that is okay or not, I don't know. I'm sure they were a perfect match and very happy. But she does get... I think she gets quite an interesting part. As you say, her sexuality is not particularly... I mean, she does show her tits in the first few minutes, but her sexuality is otherwise not particularly she's not sexualized in it, which is nice.
She has things that she cares about, and they are way more important to her than getting laid. Yeah,
and I guess that the thing about this sort of comedy is, you know, the guys, it's a bit like Some Like It Hot, really. The guys are absolutely obsessed by her, and she's got other things she's interested in and wants to she's
like actually the survival of her country.
Yes, exactly. And I like that, to be honest, until right at the end of the film when it's shown that she does kind of have affection for them, she basically uses them to get what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't particularly go dewy-eyed and fall in love with them especially. I did appreciate that as the film, you know, it's them that constantly think, oh, she will, she does, she likes, but she doesn't particularly. I mean, she likes them, but she's realistic and she's more interested in the thing that she was interested in before she met them, which I quite liked. She was quite an interesting character.
So it's Chuck brackets Hoffman who's given up his passport. So Lyle brackets Beatty goes on ahead to Morocco to say, well, at least you've got one of us, so you do actually have to pay us a little bit.
Yes, and does a terrible... I don't know, that feels like... So he does a one-man show, which I feel like in the hands of a comedy genius, I would have found incredibly funny. It's one of those so bad, cringeworthy comedy moments that weren't really in vogue at the time, except I didn't find it particularly funny.
The problem, I think, is that if the comedy is he is doing it badly and the comedy fails, what you have left is he is doing it badly.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. For some reason, it just fell a bit flat in a number of levels. But yeah, I didn't find it desperately funny. And I think partly it just feels like he's trying so hard to be funny at being bad. But that is part of my issue with the film. But anyway.
So Chuck, scrambling around to try to get a passport sorted in a hurry, runs into the local CIA guy.
Charles Grodin. Always like to see Charles Grodin. Who is, I think it's fair to say, slightly brighter than them two. but not
Who recruits Chuck as an asset without Chuck realising it.
Yes.
So, yes.
because
oh, no, you just tell us interesting stuff you see. There's no danger to it. It'll be fine.
And we'll give you some money for it.
Yeah, know. And a passport.
Yeah, so he is now working for the CIA. He then, on the strength of this, makes it to Marrakesh. And then hijinks ensue because... and again, I'm getting this... It's not that long since I saw this, but I get it mixed up. But
So Shira, the one significant female character, tries to steal Lyle's luggage because she thought it was Chuck's, in which she had hidden stuff.
Lyle to
smuggle him out of the country. She is looking for an ancient map that her brother had, working on an archaeological dig, had found. We saw this in the cutaway.
Yeah, it doesn't really have any particular significance to the plot, other than it is the thing everyone is looking for.
Well, that's the thing. He's talked up a lot in specifics. This map. It implies that the great prophesied saviour will come and be like this, and it's suggested that basically with this map she can rouse up the people to revolution. But we never see this, so
no, it doesn't. It's basically the thing that motivates everyone to do the things that they are doing. It's a MacGuffin. She then basically recruits Lyle. The Beatty character to be on the rebel team. So now we have unwittingly both of them set the scene for comedic chaos that, you know, one is kind of working for the CIA, and the reason he doesn't know is because he's out having a meal with his CIA handler, Charles Grodin. And then the other guy, Beatty, is now kind of unwittingly or wittingly working for the rebels, sort of.
And... has the hilarious instructions of go to the market, find a camel seller called Mohammed, and tell him you want to buy a blind camel.
Yeah, and again, I feel like this, like a lot of Ishtar, I feel like this should be funny, and probably if it was being Crosby and Bardot, it would have worked funny. But it just, it all falls a bit flat, doesn't it? Is that how you felt it?
But on the other hand, the next thing is my very favourite bit of the film.
Okay.
Where... both Chuck and Lyle are told by their respective handlers that you need to go into the desert to this particular place, and in one case there's a rendezvous point at these coordinates. It's not on the maps because it's secret. In the other case, you can leave this trail of special fruit
glow in the dark
to find your way back. And in both cases, the clear intention is that they will die there.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Sadly, they don't.
Well, yes, they both walk out into the desert largely unprepared. I already feel like the plot is more complex than it needs to be. It's like they've put too much thought into it. I don't think that, again, I don't know the Road 2 movies, but I feel like they probably weren't quite so convoluted as this. But the whole point is to get them walking out into the desert and die. They don't. They survive.
They discover that sewn into the jacket that Chuck is wearing, which he traded with Shira, is the map.
Their brother sewed it in there to hide it from the people who would come and get them.
Yeah.
And then they found, like, they stumble upon a kind of arms deal camp.
Mm-hmm. And this is another... It feels as if it's trying to be a comedy set piece. Ha-ha,
exactly.
These people don't speak English.
It's... semi-funny in the sense that you know it's meant to be funny. So Dustin Hoffman is kind of pretending to, in quite a racist way, I think. I don't know what he's trying to talk, Farsi or some other Middle Eastern language, but no one understands it because he's just making it up on the spot. But fortunately, he has a plant in the crowd, which is Warren Beatty's character. So he gets this kind of bidding war going. And again, that whole scene of the auction, yeah, it feels like it's supposed to be really funny. Instead, it's just like, if anything, mildly amusing. I don't know if you found it in any way amusing, but it's sort of a funny situation. Now here, I don't know who's to blame for that, because a lot of the scenes in Ishtar are like this. Is it the directing? Is it the editing? Is it the acting? What is it that makes it not work? Because in theory, that is quite funny, but I don't... even if, you know, if you ignore the kind of racism of it, if you went past that, is it funny?
Well, why isn't it? May was known for directing comedy. Director of photography is Vittorio Storaro, who's reasonably well known but not a big name. And he's a last-minute replacement. So May would say, here is where I want the cameras for the ideal comedic effect. Because that is her lexicon. Storaro says, I've never made a comedy. I'm a last-minute replacement. I want the composition that's going to look good.
Okay.
Beatty often takes Storaro's side in this, in spite of having told the entire crew that whatever May wants, she gets.
Lovely.
And so on, and so on. Made a lot of film, you know, 50 takes of vultures landing next to our principals, and so on. It was clearly going badly. They brought in, who was it? David Putnam.
Oh, Lawrence of Arabia, David Putnam.
Yeah, as producer. This is basically, after they've finished principal photography, they fire the producer and bring in David Putnam, who is notorious for being very much down on budgetary excess, and they're basically hoping he will bring it back slightly to the to vaguely not only slightly blowing the budget.
Right.
However, he has specifically criticised Reds and Beatty before. For basically using his star power to bloat up the film. He said the same thing about Hoffman in Agatha.
Brilliant.
where he basically got his minor character promoted to being a lead character.
So he doesn't like the principals.
Yeah. And, I think May more or less has the final cut over Putnam's theoretical thing, because Beatty is persuaded to, but... It's very much, you know, there is a hierarchy, and then there is what does Beatty say today.
That's really interesting, because that goes some way. I mean, I don't know the technical detail. That goes some way to... Because the effect of watching it is kind of, well, this should be funny, but it kind of isn't, and I don't know why. But, you know, if we're not getting like the comedic cues we used to, if it's just not filmed in the same way, if the cuts aren't favourable, I mean, a lot of the time, I think you mentioned this off air, the actors just look kind of tired and not very invested in the film. And I wonder if that is because they've done 50 takes and then for some reason they go for the 51st take where they just don't care anymore.
Yeah.
For some reason that it feels a bit... I think you put your finger on it when you said lifeless, again, off air. It just feels a bit flat, and I don't quite know why. I do like Beatty particularly. I do feel he has this kind of very affable kind of bumblingness about him, which is very not like Warren Beatty I've seen before. But it just, as a comedy, it's not funny, which unfortunately is a bit of a problem.
Shall we finish off the plot?
Yes, yeah. So they're
out in the desert. They have survived through a miracle. They realise they've got the map. The CIA still wants them dead, so they send a guy in a helicopter out to shoot them.
The Shah of the plane, the Freudian slip, but subtly indicating where I think this was based on. But the guy in charge wants the Americans dead. And the CIA will do it for him. They just have to make it look like an accident.
Yeah, so they send out a guy in a helicopter with a rifle, with which he unaccountably fails to kill them. Now, this is where I was thinking, hang on, we've got these famed perfectionists making this film. And there is a sequence of three shots. Shot one, we're looking at the side of the helicopter with the guy leaning out of the door with a rifle. Shot two, reaction shot with the guys on the ground. Hey, they're going to shoot at us. Shot three, we're back looking at the side of the helicopter from the same angle as the guy leans out of the door with the rifle and starts firing. And it is a completely different rifle.
They're clearly not perfectionists in the way that you would consider being a... I am no perfectionist anyway, but okay.
The thing that seems weird to me is why would you even have two separate rifles for the same shot?
Yeah, there are people whose literally their job is to check this sort of thing on set. Continuity people. But, I don't know, maybe it was a funnier rifle. I'm not sure.
But then we get... I'm sad to say, honestly, the biggest laugh I had from this film, because the helicopter with the guy and a rifle in it having failed, they send the term was battle gunship. This is not an actual military term. it's supposed to be an attack helicopter.
Right.
It's a Bell 222. That's the same model they dressed up for Airwolf. If you think the rocket pylons on the side look kind of shonky, it's because they are.
Because they're not supposed to be there.
Yeah. And, yeah. And this also fails. Let's see. The cab driver that they had been very slightly nice to earlier turns up well beyond the call of duty and saves their bacon. They have some of the weapons left from the arms deal, and they shoot back, which causes the helicopters to bug off.
We missed the blind camel thing, but it's somewhere in there. But again, it's a similar comedy set piece that just doesn't quite. I did find that an almost funny sequence for me is BT walking a blind camel through the market with it constantly hitting people. That almost made me laugh. Not quite, but almost. Clearly not you.
Eventually, they send the map to their agent, and their agent, who is actually competent, blackmails the CIA to support Shearer leading social reforms. They casually say, "Oh well, guess we're going to have to get the Emir shot."
yes,
but also back our heroes for a record release and a tour starting in Morocco.
Yes, which I quite like that it doesn't have a particularly happy ending because the record they make is shit and it fails. I think that is implied by the sequence of
But we also have the final scene in the hotel in Morocco and Shira is in tears because this is the best music she has ever heard, which, okay, I grant that works. She carries that off. And most of the rest of the audience is clearly imported from the local military base and their senior officer tells them to applaud.
Yes. If the film had earned that emotional payoff, that would have worked. It's like that sequence where... it's all right. I can see why the problems in this one led to it just not quite work. I think it was a mismatch with the director... and the stars. I can see why them all being perfectionists actually led to nothing being perfect.
Also, as we said last time about Waterworld, this is a case of Beatty was already unpopular with the media, so yeah. When the rumours started happening of bad stuff on the set and so on, they picked those up and they amplified them. It was suggested that Putnam was even leaking rumours about how bad it was, but that's never been demonstrated. Coca-Cola had bought Columbia in 82, 5 years before this, and as a result, largely of this film, they sold it off as a huge loss to Sony.
Okay. Oh, that's why we get Sony Pictures Entertainment, or whatever it's called now. Okay. It was a disaster. It wrecked a studio. Hoffman and Beatty came out all right of it in the end. Elaine May has never directed a film since, but is a highly successful writer.
It became a joke largely from people who hadn't seen it. Gary Larson did a Far Side cartoon of Hell's Video Library where it was all copies of Ishtar.
And he regretted doing that, didn't he?
Yeah, he accidentally saw it a few years later on a plane and said, you know, actually it wasn't that bad.
Well, I think that's... I preferred it to Waterworld a bit. I there were bits I enjoyed. I liked the main characters more than you did. but it commits the pretty unforgivable sin of being a comedy that isn't really funny.
Yeah, we are back in the Pauline Kael review zone, I'm very glad to say. So she said, it isn't dislikable, but it has no comic energy. May's directing is limp and passive. She doesn't do the obvious, but sometimes she doesn't do anything else either.
Funnily enough, Pauline Kael says it better than I could, but yeah, that pretty much sums it up, I think.
And that Beatty and Hoffman don't really have the kind of sketch humour savvy to goof about gracefully.
Hmm.
Which is fine. I mean, they're good at other things. This is not hitting their strong points.
I feel they're a bit too earnest in being funny, and there's nothing less funny than someone trying to be funny, unless the joke is, you know, that deliberately they're not supposed. Anyway, you could go down a whirlpool there. It's all right. Again, with a lot of these films, again, some people say, actually, it's a masterpiece. No, it isn't. No. There's a lot wrong with it. It's not the worst film in the world, however.
Again, my feeling is that if it had been a fairly small budget release, and just, yeah, it's kind of there, it wouldn't have been great, but it probably wouldn't have been the big disappointment that it was held up as being.
It probably would have been discovered by some people as a hidden gem or something, but as it was, yeah.
I mean, also, yeah, Ishtar is not the name of a country. Ishtar is the name of a specific Babylonian goddess, dash it all.
Anyway. It's a funny... I think the name didn't help it very much, because it doesn't sound like what it is, which is, or at least what it's trying to be, which is a screwball comedy. Well, shall we do a little bonus film?
Yeah, because... Indeed, while I was watching this, I was thinking, hang on a minute, I've seen another film from this period that is trying to be an homage to the Road Pictures. And that is 1985's Spies Like Us.
2 years before Ishtar.
Yeah. And this, very much like Ghostbusters, I think we could call a Saturday Night Live film.
I agree.
It's directed by John Landis. It's Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd. Several of these people were on Ghostbusters. John Landis has done Trading Places, and the part of Twilight Zone, the movie that didn't involve the helicopter death. Chevy Chase has done Fletch and the National Lampoon European Vacation. Aykroyd, obviously, Ghostbusters.
Trading Places? Actually, that might have been just after this. But
Trading Places, Landis has done that before, yeah.
This feels to me very much like that kind of... In fact, it really reminded me of Trading Places, which I love, actually, that this isn't as good as that, I don't think. But it's got it's the same kind of humour, which isn't particularly like Porky's puerile, but it's kind of childish. This is the one where, you know, Chevy Chase is the man-child who is basically... he has impulses, he follows his impulses. That's basically his character.
And it is clear that for most of his life he has simply been able to talk his way out of whatever he's got into.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Whereas Dan Aykroyd's the kind of the savant, idiot savant, I guess.
Well, he is the techie guy who's working in the basement, whose boss uses his work to make him look good while making sure he stays in the basement.
Now, I thought I'd only seen Spied Like Us once, but it's funny, you know, when it came to the... So they are... The plot is that basically they... It's not quite the authorities in China. It's almost like a splinter group, we think, of a combination of the military and the intelligence agencies. But they have a mission deep inside Russia with these agents, MS-12, I think they're called. I'm not sure if that has any analogue in real life.
Well, it's just a generic civil or foreign service rank, I think.
Right, okay. But this mission is so secret that they need a couple of decoys, so they need two disposable agents.
And conveniently, they've got these two guys who were caught doing shenanigans in the agency exam.
Well, it's funny. I remember that exam almost word for word, and I don't know why. Like, with them... some of those things come back to me to this day, but Dan Aykroyd, you know, Dan Aykroyd's very good at the kind of quick-fire technical language that sounds clever, and he's doing all that. He does it in Ghostbusters. That's kind of his shtick. But the cheating, the way Chevy Chase cheats, so he goes in with a fake broken arm and an eye patch. See, it's already making me laugh in a way that I never laughed during Ishtar. I'm not saying it's comedy genius, but they know what they're doing. They are funny, And
incidentally, this was one that did get a whole lot of celebrity cameos, starting with Frank Oz as the test running guy,
including Bob Hope. I mean, that is such a filmic thing that in one section he just walks through a tent and says, "Mind if I play through?" I just, that really actually annoyed me. but anyway, it's funnier. Just because they know what they're doing, I think, comedically.
They're not stretching themselves.
No, it's not hilarious. But Chevy Chase, you know, again, yet another actor who was apparently less nice in reality, but he's a very charming screen presence. And so is Dan Aykroyd. So they're just more likeable actors. Their characters are probably much shallower than the issue. You know, I'm sure Beatty and Hoffman went into exact details of their background and worked it all, thrashed it all out so they'd know exactly how these characters would work. That's fine.
Remembering that it is Hoffman who is always the centre of that story about him and Olivier. He's talking at great length about, you know, the Stanislavski method and, you know, how do you get into character and make sure you react the right way and so on. And Olivier just says, "Try acting, dear boy."
Now, that may well be apocryphal, but it does, I think...
I'm sure he would have said it if he'd thought of it.
So, I guess the point is that it doesn't have the depth of character, but they're just funnier people. And, you know, all that depth doesn't matter if you can't make it work. So, you know, that sequence to me stands out as, I don't know, I don't know why it made an impression on me as a kid, but I remember that quite well. I think because it is genuinely funny. And actually, the whole then they go through this whole training sequence where they go in the human centrifuge, and they get dropped from. Funnily, I remembered all those tests as well. It's not super funny, but it's little SNL style sketch comedy, isn't it? Really,
yeah. I mean, a lot of it is here is just this one joke which fits roughly into the sequence at this point. It doesn't really lead to anything else, but it's more or less in place.
Yes, exactly. Let's do this funny bit, yeah, and then we'll move on. Doesn't outstay its welcome. So they head off to they get their assignment, which is in Afghanistan, I believe. And they're immediately met by Russian agents who try and kill them. They escape the Russian agents. Not only that, they steal their jeep, and they make it to the Bedouin, which is probably highly offended, but the
generic tribesman, really.
Generic tribesman camp. Where they are mistaken for doctors.
Because there is a medical mission there.
Yes.
Where we have, you know, Ray Harryhausen and Terry Gilliam and people like that.
Yes, there's some nice little cameos in there. Was Ray Harryhausen one? I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Which one's Ray Harryhausen?
Dr. Marston.
Oh, I shall have to watch that again. But yeah, Terry Gilliam's a surprisingly big role. They end up having to almost operate on a guy, and it... Again, it's stupid, and
that was the low point, and I think possibly because that's the most Chevy Chase focused bit of it, and I don't get on with his screen persona as well as I do Aykroyd. But that's me.
Yeah, particularly the like seduction scene. Right now, it turns out two of the doctors are the actual agents, of which they are the decoys. But then there's a comedy sequence which. You know, where they have to operate on someone's appendix, but they don't know what they're doing. And it again, the whole of Spies Like His is like this, really. It's not super funny, but it's funny enough that, it, you know, it takes you through the scene. I wasn't burst out laughing, but I was thinking, oh, yeah, that's amazing. They're just better comedy actors, really. I mean, again, this surgery sequence is a bit over the top for me, and, you know, as I have had a previous life as a surgeon, perhaps I found that less funny than I should have done. But it's all right. So then they escape the camp because they kill the guy, or the guy dies of appendicitis before. It's funny how I can remember this film much better than this stuff. They escape it's just much better paced, I think.
Maybe and this is one that I saw back in the day.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It never really stood out to me as a brilliant film that I wanted to desperately see again. But I certainly enjoyed it. They escape the camp because the guy dies of appendicitis, and they get shot. They escape in an ambulance. And much to the chagrin of their handlers, who were hoping they would already have been killed, and are surprised they haven't. But then they decide to use their assets and send them even deeper on the mission, right into Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So they buy some furs, and they make it through a desert. Not the whole Arabian desert. Where are they at this
Afghan.
Point? How close are they? Oh, they're Afghanistan. Thank you. Yes, I was getting mixed up with Ishtar. And then they walk their way through to Russia.
They're crossing the Pamir Mountains into Tajikistan. Well, Tajik SSR at this point, but yeah.
Sorry, I keep saying Russia. Of course, at this point, it's the USSR. And there we have...
So one of the real agents has been killed by this point, so the three survivors team up.
Yes.
And she says, oh, right, you're the decoys, and they go, huh?
Yeah. But that sort of dispensed from then. And they are just the main characters. Chevy Chase gets taken by the Soviet police, but he's still in a... Dan Aykroyd, I'm just going to refer to it rather than learning their names, but Dan Aykroyd wants to go and rescue him. So we have a little kind of shooting sequence, slightly... Again, it's a reasonable action sequence, but again, mainly played for laughs.
Mm.
Dan Aykroyd rescues Chevy Chase, and then they head to their main objective.
Using the traditional grenade in the falling in accidentally into a box of grenades technique.
It works. The main objective is actually to hijack a Russian... I wonder if Roger's ballistic missile corner is coming up. But this
is not an actual missile launcher, but it's not wildly unlike several actual ones.
So it's a mobile... intercontinental ballistic missile launcher with a warhead on it, a nuclear warhead. And then it turns out that the idea is partly to...
None of these people has ever questioned their mission, which is to go up here, take control of the launcher, type these codes into it.
Yes, and it turns out the codes are firing the missile into the continental United States... and then I got a bit fuzzy on what the point of that
right,
was. It to galvanise the...
Well, what we've been not talking about is the whole actual plot beyond what these idiots are up
there
to.
There is a meta plot, yes.
Yeah, which I actually find rather interesting, because, again, this is a thing that is essentially missing in Ishtar. So it started off with the CIA has been tracking these various launches to try to... Keep locations on them, and then say, this is the one we will pick for this mission. They have obviously been tasked with this by, let us call it the military faction, because it's clearly not the entire military. What we see is the two generals. Who are, I think, beautifully played by, they're clearly working as character actors here, but they're doing a great job. They are both your craggy 50s film, I am the hero type.
One of them is
constantly tippling from his hip flask, like that.
I mean, they're very much like the Doctor Strangelove, precious bodily fluids characters of, I've forgotten his name.
Jack D. Ripper.
Thank you.
So what the supposed mission is, and I don't suppose they would have objected if it had worked, is... They will launch the missile and then use their ground-based particle beam weapon to shoot it down, thereby proving that this thing does actually work.
Except it doesn't.
In fact, it misses, at which point they go to plan B, which may originally have been plan A. It's not entirely clear.
It doesn't seem too
which is, we are in this nice bomb-proof bunker. We have the command authority to suppress the early warning messages about this missile. Therefore, it will explode over. I think it's over DC somewhere important anyway.
Mm.
This will be interpreted as a surprise strike. The automatic systems will launch a counter strike. We will enjoy our Twinkies in the post apocalyptic wasteland.
We will continue to enjoy the American way of life and that sort of yes.
A weapon not used is a useless weapon.
Yeah, yeah. It again. There's slightly. pantomime, but slightly horrifying. You can imagine people having that kind of attitude.
But it works, and I think largely it is because of those actors, and both the two CIA guys who are clearly moral weaklings and will just go along with whatever they're told, pretty much. And then they suddenly realise, hang on a minute, this thing we've contributed to might actually be bad.
Steve Forrest is the main... it's a role he... always play as the main general. He's just great. He's just very watchable. And they are, you know, he's the straight guy who's actually got the plot in his head.
Bruce Davison and William Prince as the two CIA guys.
Oh, Bruce Davison, of course. It's silly, but it's a plot that you can hang the comedy off.
Yeah,
and it works really well for that. You could imagine this being done as a very much like Doctor Strangelove has Failsafe, which is basically the straight version of Doctor Strangelove, which is bloody brilliant. I would encourage anyone to watch Failsafe; it's really good. This is kind of, you could imagine this being played perfectly straight in a James Bond film.
Also, I think this takes advantage of its milieu. You know, it's 85. We've seen War Games. We've seen Doctor Strangelove. We know what nuclear warfighting base looks like.
Yes.
So it can be done, frankly, on a bit of a budget, but we know what it is because it has the right visual signifiers.
I suppose in that sense that it's a bit like Airplane in the sense that they've realised actually you need a plot to hang the comedy off. And then you can be as silly as you like, but you've still got, as opposed to a, which is why The Meaning of Life is the least funny of the Monty Python films, despite some very funny bits in it. There's no plot to pull you through, and 2 hours of sketch comedy isn't compelling in the same way that a plot is.
Mm.
Anyway,
even an interval, at least, yeah.
So they launch the missile, but thankfully, and I like I like the fact that the Russian, there's only 4 Russian or Soviet guards. And there's the nice comedy moment where they all sort of pick each other. They decide, like, oh, well, let's go out with a bang. We've just started World War III. We might as well fuck. So they pick off their comedy. They pick off their partners. It turns out 2 of them are gay, and it's kind of a nice... I don't know.
Which it means the cute young lady is surplus for our heroes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it works all right for Dan Aykroyd, who then post-coitally has an idea of how to stop World War III, which is he can... I don't know how likely this is, but he can...
Absolutely not.
I didn't think so. Once it's launched...
He can reprogram the missile in flight to go to somewhere completely different and explode harmlessly.
I didn't think that was possible.
No. It's... Basically, once you have fired off the missile, it has no capability of receiving a signal, because obviously if it could, everybody would be making great efforts to redirect it or whatever. Also, the actual burning phase is only a few minutes out of the flight time, and after that it's purely ballistic. So
yeah, then it's run out of fuel.
You could do is a high altitude burst, which would just cause an electromagnetic pulse over the whole eastern US rather than destroying Washington.
I was going to say, I imagine you could cause it to destruct from a distance early. Okay, all right. Anyway,
but even then, you would need some sort of signal channel, and that just isn't there.
That makes sense. Yeah. Otherwise, everyone. The best missile defense would be hacking into their radios.
Yeah, anyway, but for the purposes of this film,
we might be giving it a pass. But to be honest, Waterworld committed a lot more sins than I was already pissed off by.
It makes no sense at all. But there isn't really a way of rewriting the plot to make it work. So
no, and it would have been a sad ending to the film if it was a Doctor Strangelove ending.
To the strains of we'll meet again, obviously.
It gives Dan Aykroyd's techie character a chance to do his techie thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a silly ending, but it's a silly film, so it's fair enough.
So they do that. The real army, the loyalist army, as you might say, bursts into the bunker and arrests everybody, including the CIA guys who try to talk their way out of it but fail.
Yeah. So they're all, which leaves our heroes to have their very silly happy ending in a, basically they're playing Risk. Is it Risk? Something like
Trivial
that.
Trivial Pursuit?
Trivial Pursuit. That's it. Yes,
but basically they are, somehow they have got their Soviet counterparts involved in these in arms negotiation talks as well, and they are drunkenly playing whatever game they're playing to sort out the world rather than build up missiles.
Yeah, it's a nice again. Like what we said with Ishtar, it didn't really earn that ending. Spies Like Us does. I mean, it doesn't have high. I mean, Spies Like Us was reasonably high budget by the looks of it. Sorry, my vowels betrayed me there. Budget. Well, it doesn't matter. I've got to pick one and stick with it. But by the looks of it, it looks good. Maybe it wasn't too high budget, but it did really, really well. Which may have, I don't know whether that inspired Ishtar or not.
I've never heard it suggested, and all the accounts I've read of the production of Ishtar was that May decided that there hadn't been a road film for a while and she wanted it. I mean, this didn't get great critical reviews.
No, fair enough. I mean, it's not a great film, but it passes the time, doesn't it? It's nice enough.
Yeah, it's reasonably short, and to be being fair to Ishtar, it's also reasonably short, 100-110 minutes.
A bit longer, though. I think you are absolutely spot on to put these two films together, because they're both trying to do the same thing, and one of them succeeds in its fairly low expectations, I think. And that's what you want from a film, a bit like we said with Ice Pirates. It's not aiming high, but what it does really well. And Spies Like Us, I don't think does as well as Ice Pirates, but it hits the target. Ishtar just doesn't.
But also, the Spies Like Us has a budget of 22 mil and a box office of 77, whereas Ishtar has a budget of 51 and a box office of 14.
dear me. I think even Waterworld made money in the end, so I could see why Ishtar was a bit of a disaster.
I think as really the big contrast between this and the other two is this is a disposable summer film like the other two, but it's not trying to be anything more.
Yeah.
And so I can look back and say, yeah, I quite enjoyed that, and this is why I suggested we look at it for this.
Yeah.
Because it has that similar genesis, but it's just a completely different way of making the film as a result of that initial idea.
Yeah, it's no masterpiece. It's not a pinnacle of the form. It's not even a pinnacle of the SNL films in a way, because I prefer both Trading Places and Ghostbusters. But
yeah,
it does what it does what it's supposed to do. Good. And with Ishtar, not the worst film in the world. I don't know why. I found myself feeling more warmly to it than Waterworld. I think just because Kevin Costner. Waterworld annoyed me, but it's not a terrible film. Ishtar bored me, and for a comedy, that's not a good thing, is it?
This is the problem, that if horror fails, if action fails, it can be laughable.
Yeah.
But if you set out to be funny and it fails, then you've basically got nothing left.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great... And the plot in Spies Like Us doesn't feel convoluted, even though I suppose it is. The plot in Ishtar feels needlessly convoluted. I don't know whether it is or not, but it felt too much. And as you say, we do get a bit of that meta plot between the Amir and Charles Grodin's character, but it's not that compelling. There we are. Another worst film of all time that, funnily enough, wasn't the worst film of all time, but it wasn't amazing either, to be
well, sure. I think the last of the ones of this period would probably be Heaven's Gate.
Yes, I've wondered about Heaven's Gate. I am averse to it because of the notorious animal cruelty in it, and I find that hard to get past. I'm going to look into
enough.
It and see how bad it was, because it might be worth doing a trilogy, because that one, basically... That was the worst film of all worst films, in that pretty much ended the American the era of the American New Wave. It was already dying by then, but that finished it off.
It certainly killed off the Western for a good few years.
Yeah, yeah. And I would like to see it, but I'll see. I'll look into how bad the animal cruelty was.
It's not going to be next time anyway.
No. All right, well, there we are. Another terrible film. terrorised. We will return anon.